It is Monday, November the 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Syrian refugees and what U.S. politicians are saying about them.
They're really, truly exploiting this tragedy for political gain. When Donald Trump says, let's monitor mosques, let's make a list of Muslims, when Marco Rubio endorses a similar idea, when Jeb Bush says that let's only let Christians into the country.
Also ahead, the Pope and Central African Republic, plus climate change on the agenda at a Paris summit. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Syrian activists say airstrikes believed to be from Russian planes have killed at least 18 people, wounded 40 others in northern Syria. Meantime, the European Union has agreed to a multi-billion dollar deal with Turkey on migration in hopes of addressing the flow of migrants going to Turkey and EU countries. And here in the U.S., a divisive debate continues over the fate of refugees. But in New York City, community organizations are welcoming incoming refugees. Ramon Taylor has our report.
So far, roughly 2,200 Syrian refugees have arrived on U.S. soil, 77% of them women and children, according to the State Department. Only a handful have landed in New York, but Mayor Bill de Blasio, who has called New York a proud immigrant city, says the city will not turn its back on those who are persecuted and fleeing war, calling Muslim New Yorkers crucial allies in the fight against terrorism. Republican presidential candidates Ted Cruz and Jeb Bush have called on the U.S. to accept Syrian Christian refugees, but not Muslims. Donald Trump says he will accept no Syrians and vowed to monitor selected mosques if elected. Dr. Ahmad Jaber, president of the Arab American Association of New York and Dawood Mosque, calls this rhetoric unconstitutional.
How dare you say you are not welcoming refugees? Now, how dare you say that based on their faith, you are not welcoming them because they are Muslims?
Dawood, in the heart of Brooklyn, was the first mosque established in the state of New York in 1939. Today, there are more than 270. Dr. Jaber says the community, comprised of immigrants from Yemen, Egypt, Palestine, and Syria, among others, welcomes refugees, both Muslim and Christian. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
And for some perspective on all of this, including efforts by some members of Congress to alter immigrant and visa programs, specifically for people coming from the part of the world where the Islamic State militants are carrying out a bloody battle to establish a caliphate. VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with two analysts. Igor Volsky is director of video and contributing editor of ThinkProgress.org, a progressive political blog affiliated with the Center for American Progress. And John Fortier, director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
Well, Igor Volsky, let me begin with you to talk about this so-called politics of fear that we're witnessing. Certainly, it's legitimate to discuss the fallout from these terrorist attacks, to look at legislation to bolster our national security. But it does appear, as I suggested, that some politicians are proposing measures which are either antithetical to that or playing up to stereotypes, both of which are counterproductive, to say the least. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, they're really, truly exploiting this tragedy for political gain. When Donald Trump says, let's monitor mosques, let's make a list of Muslims, when Marco Rubio endorses a similar idea, when Jeb Bush says that let's only let Christians into the country, it's really challenging, I think, because not only is that kind of rhetoric, as the president laid out, contradictory to American values and American democracy, but it will also do nothing to keep America safer. You mentioned the visa waiver program, which is something lawmakers are looking at and thinking, should we allow people who have been to Iraq or Syria, say, in the last year, but are entering the country from France or Brussels or some other country on the no visa list, should they be vetted? Should they be required to obtain a visa? And all of that makes sense. Rational policy prescription in the aftermath of Paris makes sense. Fear-mongering is, I think, just a very, very sad and poor political ploy.
Turning to you, John Fortier, and I think it's interesting and relevant to note a contrast in tone and substance from the way some of the Republican candidates are reacting to this tragedy and how former Republican President George W. Bush reacted in the wake of 9/11. In the wake of 9/11 attacks, he made it very clear that we are not at war with Islam. He went to mosques, etc., in order to protect the majority of Muslims who have nothing to do with these attacks. And, of course, we also witness French President François Hollande, whose country was attacked, but who said, and he underscored and reiterated that nonetheless that they will be accepting Syrian refugees. So your reaction to what's going on, and particularly some of the presidential contenders and their reactions?
Well, I do think you see rhetoric descending in a way, especially from the front runner, Donald Trump, and policies of excluding Muslims particularly, which are getting some pushback. But I think on the other side, you see a deteriorating situation. These are issues that are caused in part by all of the problems that are flowing from the Syria problem and debates that we are having in Europe as well about what the right mix of immigration is, but also what the right mix of security is. I guess I would say this. If you look beyond the rhetoric, you look to some votes that took place in the Congress. So the House of Representatives asked the president and his cabinet to certify that they would be keeping terrorists out of the country in this program. Also, just generally, some calls for a pause or some reconsideration of what we're doing. I think that is something that has gained a lot of traction with the American people. You saw 47 Democrats voting for this sort of approach, feeling that the administration really is insisting on this refugee policy as the end-all be-all and really not doing enough to address terrorism. I think underlying this are worries about immigration, but also worries about the president's general foreign policy and dealing with terrorism. His numbers on dealing with terrorism are at an all-time low for his administration. The country doesn't feel comfortable with his policies. They are more likely to turn to Republicans both on the direct aspects of foreign policy and in the immigration fallout on this. So I share your worries about some of the overblown rhetoric as to what might be done. But I think when you get to the sort of practical policies, the president is fighting against public opinion.
John Fortier, he's director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Igor Volsky, director of video and contributing editor of thinkprogress.org at the Center for American Progress. As always, thank you for your terrific insights.
And thank you, Carol. Carol Castile hosts the VOA program Encounter. You can hear more of their conversation by going to voanews.com and look under the Programs tab for Encounter. President Obama and world leaders arriving in Paris for the start of a high-stakes climate change summit. The goal of the event is for the 195 participating nations to reach a legally binding agreement to limit global warming. International Edition's Michael Lippin speaks with VOA correspondent Arup Pandey in the French capital and asked her why the summit is so important to President Obama.
You've seen him work both domestically and internationally on this issue for the last few years now. He's helped bring other nations along, whether it be Brazil, India, or China. The agreement that was struck while he was in China, where Beijing agreed to peak its emissions by 2030, that was looked at as a very huge agreement to get China to agree to that. So he's been instrumental in bringing the world's most populous countries along, Brazil, India, China, and also the other countries, Malaysia. Every world leader that he meets with, whether abroad or domestically, when they visit the White House, climate change comes up.
Well, now that Obama seems to have so many world leaders on board with this goal of tackling climate change, how do all of those leaders hope to make this conference in Paris different from its predecessors?
Well, the White House has touted that so far some 170 countries around the world, representing about 90% of the global emissions, have put forward their post-2020 targets, saying that they're going to curb carbon emissions by such and such levels domestically in their own nations, and basically how that would work towards limiting the global rise of temperature. So far, the White House and the United States has helped other nations commit to these to curbing carbon emissions. They really wanted to go forward differently, not just the United States, but other major nations. We saw what happened in Copenhagen and also with Kyoto, that it was almost like chaos in Copenhagen with countries dissatisfied with some of the top-down approach that was being taken. Now, world leaders, including President Obama, want climate targets set by the countries themselves, not imposed on them. They want the countries to be involved and to look at their own nations and see what they can realistically do. They also want to focus on the poorer countries. That has always been the biggest contention. These poorer countries who say, look, you, the United States, have been using coal and other energies to grow your economies and industry. Now that we're doing it, you're asking us to curtail that, and we don't have the money and the technology to do so in an affordable way. So what the United States is trying to do along with the other major nations is basically not just focus on development assistance to these poor countries, but helping them access clean energy technology and basically getting the private sector involved in trying to make this technology more accessible in the marketplace. So they really want to make this clean energy technology available to poorer countries and developing countries. But the approach is this: they don't want to talk down to any nation and make sure that nations are all coming on equal footing to try to say, look, this is what we can contribute to make a significant change in reducing carbon emissions.
That is VOA's Arup Pandey in Paris. She was speaking with my colleague, Michael Lippin. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. A leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Senior Burundian army officer was wounded during an ambush. Colonel Serge Kobanyura was shot Saturday when unidentified gunmen opened fire on his vehicle outside the capital, Bujumbura. Violence has plagued that East African country since President Pierre Nkurunziza announced in April his intention to seek a controversial third term in office. He won the disputed election in July. Pope Francis is continuing his three-nation Africa tour in the Central African Republic after visiting Kenya and Uganda. The CAR has been in chaos since a coup 2 years ago led to bloody intercommunal violence between Muslims and Christians. Later today, Francis will visit a mosque in Bangui's largely Muslim PK5 neighborhood. International Edition's Victor Beatty asked Catholic University of America religion and culture professor Pim Baltenberg whether it's unusual for a pope to visit a mosque.
It's certainly unusual in the sense that there is little precedent for it. I think Pope John Paul II was the first to visit the mosque, and then Pope Benedict and now Pope Francis has have followed his example. But what is, of course, most significant is that he is going to a mosque in what can be described as kind of a territory in which it might not be very safe for Christians to be. So it's kind of a warlike situation in which he goes to a sacred place that would be described, I think, by many Christians as kind of a dangerous place for him to go to.
And holding an open-air mass also is fraught with security issues. This is a city that is divided along Christian-Muslim lines. How successful has his message been? He urged on Sunday that to all those who make unjust use of weapons of this world, I make this appeal, lay down these instruments of death.
Well, I think you cannot measure the success of a pope's message in political sense, in the sense that, okay, so many people obey his commands or whatever. I think his wish is more a long-term wish, and I think that his actions could be seen more at a symbolical level, in a similar way in which he tried to bring together, I think it's 2 years ago, the Palestinian president and the Israeli president to pray together for peace. Of course, that did not immediately establish peace. But I think Pope Francis is quite aware that his task as a religious leader is somewhat different from the task of a political leader. And in that sense, you could not expect immediate changes. It is more, I think, the kind of example that he wants to give. And in that sense, I think that his actions are very significant.
Well, nonetheless, he's putting, you might say, his theological capital on the line in going to such a dangerous place with such a Muslim-Christian divide.
That is true, but you can also say, well, he's in fact showing the world that there is another story about Christian-Muslim relations than the story that we hear usually in the press. Because in the Central African Republic there have been significant improvements in the relations between Christians and Muslims by the religious leaders of that place. So even though, of course, at the ground level there is still a lot of tension, there are also religious leaders who have shown extreme courage to come together and to really promote a better type of relationship between Muslims and Christians. And I think the fact that he is visiting the Central African Republic and that he is going exactly to these places shows that he wants to underline these actions of the local religious leaders and to support them.
Pim Balkenberg is a religion and culture professor at Catholic University of America, and he was speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Niger's main opposition party has selected its candidate to stand against incumbent President Mahamadou Issoufou, who is seeking a second five-year term. National Movement for Development and Society chose Sanya Omaru on Sunday to contest next February's election. Another presidential hopeful, Hama Amadou, who returned in mid-November from exile, was arrested, charges with involvement of baby trafficking scheme. Niger is taking part in a regional force, you might remember, to quell the Boko Haram insurgency. Voters in Burkina Faso Sunday voted for president and members of parliament in the first election since a popular uprising ended decades of rule by Blaise Compaoré, who failed in his attempt to extend his 27-year rule.
C'est un jour historique à plusieurs titres. C'est la première fois donc que nous avons des élections.
Union for Progress candidate Zéphirin Diabré called it a historic day, the first time we had seen such an election, he said. He also says it will be marking a new beginning for the country's democracy. 5 million registered voters were eligible to select from among a slate of 14 presidential candidates. Officials have begun counting the ballots, and the first results expected late today. If no one earns more than 50% of the vote, a second round will be held. Country has been run by transitional government after Mr. Compaoré was forced to flee the country in October of 2014. The election was to have been held October the 11th, but the timetable was interrupted by a coup attempt by Compaoré loyalist and presidential guard in September that fizzled after a week. It is time now to check out what's trending online, and it looks like U.S. Republican Party presidential contender Donald Trump is it. Our social media correspondent G. Abby Lee is here with the story. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. His campaign invited several black pastors to meet with him Monday, but one by one, they're denying that they had plans to endorse him at the event. It's still Sunday here in America, so the comments are coming out a day before the event, and as of now, his presidential campaign has canceled a press conference that was scheduled for after the meeting.
So, G, who was invited to the event?
A number of quote-unquote celebrity pastors who appeared on reality TV. They're also members of the Coalition of African American Ministers. One of them is Bishop Clarence McClendon. He's based in L.A. and appeared in a show called The Preachers of L.A. McClendon wrote on Facebook that he's not going to attend the meeting, and he elaborated that the meeting was presented not as a meeting to endorse, but a meeting to engage in dialogue. But obviously, Trump's campaign wants to get endorsement from these influential leaders, and this is what his spokesperson said Sunday. This is not a press event, but a private meeting, after which a number of attendees are expected to endorse Mr. Trump's campaign for president.
Well, I understand. One can hope, right? Tell us about a couple more responses.
Sure. Bishop Corletta Vaughn, who appeared in Preachers of Detroit, also said she will not endorse Trump. She wrote a scathing response on Facebook, and it reads like this. Trump is an insult, an embarrassment. But he represents the country we have become. Zero experience, flaunting a ticket of unbridled bigotry, sexism, racism, and everything that is wrong with America. Bishop Paul Morton tweeted Friday that he refused to meet with the presidential candidate, calling him disrespectful. Now, the controversy could not have come at a worse time for Trump because, as you know, a Black Lives Matter activist got thrown out of his rally last week after being physically assaulted. Steve?
Many thanks, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. If you'd like to follow her on Twitter, her handle is at G. Abby Lee. And you can also find International Edition on Twitter. We're at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
NASA has taken an important step in completing construction of the James Webb Space Telescope it hopes to launch in 2018. Recently, engineers and technicians at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland used a robotic arm to successfully install the first of the new space telescope's 18 flight mirrors. NASA says that the mirror segments are made of an ultralight material called beryllium and is coated with a thin layer of gold. Once the pieces are installed sometime early next year, they will work together as one 6.5-meter mirror. The mirror, along with other state-of-the-art technologies that have been developed for the new space telescope, will allow scientists to study the first stars and galaxies created after the Big Bang and will play an important role in searching for possible life on distant exoplanets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. You know, there is a growing number of younger performers out there making the music scene. Well, they're playing music and singing the songs from the Great American Songbook and many of the other pop, jazz, and rock tunes that have been big hits for decades. One of the bright, relatively new talents is multi-instrumentalist Kate Davis, known for playing the double bass.
I'm gonna lock my heart and throw away the key, 'cause I'm wise to all those tricks you played on me. I'm gonna turn my back on love, gonna snub the moon above, fill my windows up with tin so the lover can't get in. I'm gonna park my romance right along the curb, put a sign up on my heart, please don't disturb. 'Cause if I never fall in love again, that's soon enough for me. I'm gonna lock my heart and throw away the
Billy Eaton and Terry Shan wrote, "I'm Gonna Lock My Heart and Throw Away the Key," for one of the greats of the jazz scene, Billie Holiday.
I said, I'm gonna lock my heart and throw away the key, 'cause I'm wise to all those tricks you played on me. I said, I'm gonna turn above, fill my windows up with tin so the lover can't get in. I'm gonna park my romance right along the curb, put a sign up on my heart, please don't disturb. 'Cause if I never fall in love again, that's soon enough for me. I'm gonna lock my heart, lock my heart. I'm gonna lock my heart and throw away the key.
Kate Davis was born in 1991 in West Lynn, Oregon. That's in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, and went on to play with the Portland Youth Philharmonic, becoming a presidential scholar in the arts, and studying at the Manhattan School of Music.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. No religion to.
Kate Davis on the keyboards this time, singing John Lennon's Imagine. Recently, Kate has shared the stage with such diverse artists as Alison Krauss, Josh Groban, Ben Folds, and Renee Fleming.
That I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be as one. Imagine no possessions.
I tell you who's got some possessions. That's NBA star Kobe Bryant. Well, he's decided to retire after this season. National Basketball Association great, ending his 20-year career with the Los Angeles Lakers. 37-year-old Bryant went straight from high school, you might remember, to suburban Philadelphia, where he went to high school, right onto the Lakers in 1996. He earned 5 championship rings and 17 All-Star selections during 2 decades with the franchise. Longest tenure with one team in NBA history. Bryant also won some gold medals, a couple of them. Has had some injuries lately, but retiring. Listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Around the world, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Vietnam, Syria, Russia, Iran, and other countries, journalists are under siege and freedom of expression is under threat. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports that in 2014, more than 60 journalists were killed, hundreds imprisoned, and dozens remain missing. Reporters Without Borders notes that governmental attempts to silence journalists include censorship, harassment, restrictive NGO laws, and public threats by political leaders. Speaking at Columbia University in New York, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs Richard Stengel, himself a former journalist, described freedom of expression as a foundational human right. Challenges to that freedom, he said, are now deeper and more profound than at any time in decades. He described 3: the physical dangers journalists confront in conflict zones and elsewhere, the shrinking space for free expression in countries with autocratic leadership, and the rise of disinformation. In the past, journalists trying to expose the truth were given a kind of safe pass, said Undersecretary Stengel. Now they are targets of regimes and of terrorists like ISIL. As such, supporting freedom of the press is a critical element of U.S. foreign policy. It is one of the issues that our diplomats around the world regularly address in bilateral talks with governments. One initiative provides trainings to journalists on physical and digital security and psychosocial care throughout the world. And the U.S. has invested over $100 million in internet freedom programs to provide tools and trainings to thousands of vulnerable civil society and independent journalists around the world. Finally, in response to the rise of disinformation from terrorist groups or autocratic regimes, the U.S. is being proactive, said Undersecretary Stengel, in claiming the space for truth-telling by pushing back on propaganda and falsehood with fact-based messages, as well as by supporting independent media around the world with financial, technical, and logistical support. And why? Because, as President Barack Obama has said, journalists give all of us as citizens the chance to know the truth about our countries, ourselves, our governments. That makes us better. It makes us stronger.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.